If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Can we follow in the footsteps of our prehistoric and medieval forebears? Well, archaeologist Dr. Jim Leary of the University of York would like us to try, because he's been researching the importance of mobility and travel in the period. Our content director, Dave Musgrove, called him to find out more.
Dr. Jim Leary is lecturer in field archaeology at the University of York. And Jim, you've written an article in the journal Antiquity with Professor Martin Bell, which is called Pathways to the Past, A Positive Approach to Routeways and Mobility. And I saw that on Twitter and had a look at it. And then we were chatting on social media and you shared with me an unpublished manuscript that you've written and which incidentally is looking for a publisher, provisionally entitled Rome, which talks about the archaeology of travel and movement more generally. So that's the conversation that I wanted to chat about today. So Jim, thank you very much for joining us. I hope you're well.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Yes, really delighted to be talking about Rome.
Okay, good. So let's start off with just the basic premise. So we tend to focus, when we're thinking about archaeology, we tend to focus on archaeological sites, graves, or static places. But that means that we overlook one of the basic aspects of life, which is mobility. And in that recent article that I mentioned in the introduction, I'm just going to do a little quote. You said, concentrating on sites removes the physical evidence of bodily movement from the discourse and imposes a stillness on the past. So what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that when we look at archaeology, when we talk about archaeology, in fact, when we talk about the past more generally, we see it as a series of static images. You know, there's a headline that often crops up when archaeology is found in the newspapers, and that's frozen in time. And we talk about that quite often, this idea that archaeology is this static image, this point that's frozen in time. And what that does is remove a really key aspect of what it is to be human. And of course, that key aspect is mobility, it's moving. And when we remove mobility from our discussion, we remove some of the things that make us human, that make life enliven the past. And you know, in one sense, I think it's perfectly understandable. We talk about monuments and place a lot in archaeology, and place is sort of a very tangible thing. You can see it, you can go to it, you can go inside monuments, you can draw boundaries around them. But what it does by doing that is remove the movement, the liveliness of the past. In a sense, it's a form of disenchantment. I think we rob the past of some of the actual life. So what I want to do is put back that liveliness. I want to recreate that sort of buzz on the along the roads and the paths of the past. You know, that sort of hubbub, the shouts and the chatting, the gossip, and all of these things. These all happened along paths. You know, life happens on the move. It doesn't happen in place. Or to put it another way, place is actually a tangle of different sorts of movements. So what I was trying to do with the book is put that richness back into the past.
And you definitely do. In the manuscript you sent me, you bring that to life, and you bring some of the poetry, I suppose, of the motion of life and moving around into it. So if there is a publisher out there looking for a good topic like that, then it's worth a look. But is this a new field of study then? Because I tend to think that we do focus on monuments and you read archaeological textbooks and stuff, and they do rightly, as you say, focus on the things that don't move around so much. So is this something that the archaeologists have been picking up on recently and trying to forge a new field of study?
Well, I mean, mobility has always come into archaeology. We've always talked about mobility. And of course, we talk about mobility an awful lot now in archaeology because we have these amazing new techniques such as ancient DNA study or isotope analysis. I mean, isotopes are just wonderful because you can, to some degree, you can determine where somebody, the geological area, somebody grew up. And and you can compare that to where they ended up, so you can sort of see where people came from and went to. But what you're actually looking at there are places, what place they came up, they grew up, and what place they ended up. And we do the same with objects. You know, you can look at the people talk about the movement of objects, but they're actually talking about the place that it was made or came from originally and the place it ended up. The journey in between is the bit that we very rarely talk about in archaeology. So we are talking about mobility, but in a very different way to the way that I would like it to be conceived.
Okay, so it's the human experience of moving that you're trying to get to, which seems like a very valuable place to try and understand. So just thinking about this conversation, obviously there's an awful lot we could talk about here. So I'd like to try and structure the conversation to move from prehistory through to the Middle Ages, and we probably won't go far beyond that in terms of chronology. So let's try and start at the beginning or a sort of beginning when we look at a period in question. So archaeologists talk of a boundary between periods, between the Mesolithic and the Neolithic, and that's when the traditional view is we move from a hunter-gatherer society to a more settled agricultural society. So one might imagine that leads these farming groups to be less mobile because they're tied to the land. They're having to grow crops and the like. That's not quite right, according to some of the stuff in your book.
That's right. So I'm absolutely fascinated by this because this is an idea that we grow up with. This idea that we sort of come from this kind of wandering wildness in our past, and through a linear evolution, we slowly settle down and grew crops and became civilized. This idea of progressing from a wandering wildness to some sort of settled civilization is, it just flows through our understanding of the prehistoric past. And anthropologists have been telling us for some time that actually not all hunter-gatherers move around very much. In fact, some hunter-gatherers move around in a very small way, very minimally, some a lot less than supposedly sedentary horticulturalists. And we sort of see this in the archaeology as well. We're getting growing evidence for rather large or larger houses in the early Mesolithic, houses that quite clearly would have been used intergenerationally, tying people to particular places. And at the same time, these the isotopes we talked about earlier, the isotope studies on Neolithic populations show that actually they're moving around quite a lot throughout their lifetime. And so I think we just need to move away from this idea of seeing mobility is as a one-way street, if you forgive the pun. Incidentally, mobility lends itself to huge numbers of puns and jokes and various things. But if this idea of a linear evolution It's a fallacy that sort of exists throughout all the writing on prehistory, really. It doesn't necessarily need to be that way. And of course, mobility isn't a one-way street either. You can increase your mobility and you can decrease your mobility, and communities do over various times. And within your community, of course, you have some people who are more mobile and others who are less. You always do. In our society, we do. It was the same in the past. So I want to get away from this idea that we are sort of over the millennia, over the generations, slowly becoming more settled, less mobile. However, we're supposedly a sedentary civilization now, and we move around more than we probably ever have done in the past. I mean, we're truly global individuals. So I'm just trying to move away from this idea. You know, yes, hunter-gatherers are mobile, but they're not all mobile, and they're not always more mobile than farmers. Farmers move around an awful lot, especially small-scale horticulturalists.
So how easy, then, is it to actually see evidence of travel and mobility in prehistory from an archaeological perspective? So you mentioned things like axes and artifacts. You can see them moving from one place to another. You can see their provenance and you can see if they end up somewhere else. And that's a fairly obvious way that must have moved, and there must have been some human agency to move it there. But can you actually see physical evidence of mobility back in the prehistoric record?
Well, again, this is something that's incredibly difficult to spot. So mobility is a little bit like trying to see wind. You know, you can't really see it, but you can see the impact of it on the sort of environment around it. And the same is true with mobility. So we can see, for example, things like routeways in the landscape, you know, parallel linear ditches or sometimes ditch and banks. They often survive, particularly in upland areas, quite often fossilized within later prehistoric field systems. We can see rows of barrows, round barrows, which are burial mounds, but they quite clearly once marked routeways known as what we call barrow roads. And you see them in this country, they've been studied quite a lot more in Europe. But of course, we also have wooden trackways that survive in waterlogged areas. We get them, there's plenty in Ireland. We get them in Somerset through the Neolithic and the Bronze Age, and you get them elsewhere in the country. I excavated a lovely one in East London, actually, which is Bronze Age in date. And these trackways are sometimes really well made. Sometimes they're nothing more than just brushwood laid down over a waterlogged area, and they're literally just to allow people to cross boggy areas. And of course, then the waterlogged area or the peat grows up around it and preserves the timber. So you can date them incredibly accurately. The most famous example is the Sweet Track in Somerset, which is we can date through dendrochronology the felling of the wood to 3806 or 7 BC, I forget which. With it so amazingly precise, even the time of year it was the wood was felled. And these trackways were designed for people to cross the waterlogged area, or sometimes to give people access out into the waterlogged area for hunting or perhaps for ritual purposes. I mean, that seems to be the case, that the waterlogged areas are sort of ritual landscapes, not quite land and not quite water, but sort of liminal zone in between the two. And so you often get deposits of axes, or in later prehistory, metalwork, or, you know, sometimes actual human bodies, sacrifice bodies. So, you know, these trackways are wonderful ways of sort of telling, of kind of understanding movement in the past.
So I did my PhD on the Somerset Levels, and one of my supervisors was one of the excavators of the Sweet Track. And if I remember rightly, it's one of the rare examples where you can actually kind of see movement, because someone had dropped a bag of hazelnuts or something along the course of the route, hadn't they? And that had been preserved in situ there. So that's it's kind of that's a standout moment. It's a bit of a rare exemplar of being able to actually see it. But I suppose footprints as well might be examples there.
Yes, absolutely. There's some wonderful examples of footprints in, for example, the Severn Estuary. Again, you mentioned my colleague, Professor Martin Bell. He's been excavating them over years. And generally, the ones he's been looking at are Mesolithic in date. And they're just, you know, they're just stunning. Those literally are a moment in time captured in a series of footprints. And he has examples of, you know, people walking side by side out into the estuarine mud. There's a wonderful example of two small children, one slightly older, the other dancing around the older one. And you can really, you know, really sort of conjures this image of a small child full of energy and jumping around. And at some point, there's only one set of footprints, but those set of footprints are slightly deeper. And quite clearly, the older child has picked up the younger one, perhaps slightly frustrated with it dancing around. So these little moments are captured in footprints. You know, they're a wonderful, tangible example of mobility in the past.
Yeah, they are amazing to just think of those survivals. So you talked a bit about the trackways there, and we can actually see evidence of how things were constructed and how people were moving around those wetland areas. And you know, it's a bit more esoteric, the evidence, I suppose, on dry land, because it doesn't survive as well. But are you able to sort of give us a sense about the sorts of routes that people were travelling on in prehistory, and I suppose how much investment in maintenance or construction of travelling routes was made?
Well, the routes that we see preserved within the field systems in the upland area, clearly they're part of a laid out landscape, and there's some degree of thought going on. But it's, I mean, this is a really difficult subject to nail, I mean, to get stuck into, because A, they're very, very difficult to date. Only really now are we beginning to get the kinds of techniques and technologies required to date them properly. And even then, it's still very tentative and very difficult. And, you know, people often talk about things like ridgeways forming big routeways in prehistory. And, you know, the ridgeway that runs across from Norfolk down into Wiltshire is a prime example of, you know, people describe it being the earliest road and things like this. Actually, you know, the evidence is pretty slim on the ground for that particular ridgeway to be a prehistoric routeway. I mean, we sort of have later prehistoric features running right across it and disregarding it. So, I mean, there's certainly good evidence for the ridgeway being a routeway in the Saxon and later periods, but in prehistory there isn't so much. I wonder how much rivers were really the major highways of the day in prehistory. This is something that's sort of often forgotten about in discussions of mobility in the past. The rivers in many ways are much easier, and you can sort of access sort of larger areas through rivers.
So just going back to the ridgeway for a second, because I do find that fascinating. I ran along a bit of the ridgeway back earlier in the summer, and it is in Wiltshire, and you're running past Barrows and Hill Forts and Wayland Smithy, this prehistoric monument there, which has a sort of a Saxon name nowadays. And you do feel like you're sort of running in the past a bit, because you're running past so much interesting history. But I suppose the marketing is quite interesting there, because it is advertised as this, you know, really ancient road. I can't remember exactly what their branding is. But is that helpful to us in our understanding of ancient prehistoric movement, to have things marketed like that, when perhaps they're not actually reflective of a reality back in the Neolithic period, for instance?
Well, I don't want to take away a beloved prehistoric routeway from everybody, but I think if we're going to call it a prehistoric routeway, we need to do some serious work on it and actually determine whether it is or not, and not just allow this to become sort of hand-down knowledge that it is a... I mean, I think they brand it as the earliest road, don't they? I think if we're going to say that, we actually need some scientific evidence to back it up, which means we need to do some work, some proper archaeological work. work. And in the case of the Ridgeway, when archaeological work has been done, it's been conclusively shown not to be, you know, maybe it was used at times as a routeway, but it certainly was no road, as it's described, certainly wasn't something that was used for any length of time. The other type of feature which people generally do love, and that is the holloways. And I mean, I adore holloways. They, you know, I find them deeply moving, romantic places to go, you know, very evocative of the past. And holloways, they're formed literally by the passage of feet and horses' hooves and carts clattering down them, and they erode deep down, helped often by flooding in the winter where rainwater will wash down them and sort of essentially turn them into rivers, and that erodes even further. But these wonderful old holloways, when we do look at them scientifically, and this is something that again, Martin Bell has really pioneered, actually we can trace the origins back frequently back into prehistory. You know, Martin has been able to date some back to certainly the Iron Age, if not the later Bronze Age in some instances. So those are the sorts of things, you know, forget the Ridgeway, walk along holloways, and there you really are treading in the footsteps of ancestors.
Great. Maybe we'll come back to just a few examples of places where you can experience past travel experience at the end of the podcast. Why, we've talked a little bit about this, but why would people have been travelling in the past? What would have been their motivations? I mean, you can think of some obvious reasons for, you know, purposes of agriculture and that sort of thing. But today, obviously, travel, there's various reasons why you could travel and many of them for leisure purposes. I guess that's not one thing that we should think about for the past, or maybe we should.
Well, I don't see why not. You know, I think there's this idea that, again, it's a little bit like that division between the Mesolithic and the Neolithic that's very pervasive. And that's that people didn't move around very much in the past. And what we're showing through things like isotope analysis is that people did move around, and they moved around a lot, not just in prehistory, but throughout the historic periods. And so, you know, throughout the historic periods, people of all levels of life, all walks of life, moved around, and for a variety of reasons. It could be just a sense of freedom, but it could be going from one place to another to visit relatives. It could be merchants on the move. It could be pilgrims on the move. It could be messengers. You know, the military used these. And then, of course, you get big royal cavalcades going down, you know, clattering down roads with a sort of huge circus in tow of knights and courtiers and jesters and, you know, a great big show. And so a whole variety of people used roads for a whole variety of reasons. You can imagine them alive with activity, and not least, of course, drovers and people moving with their animals.
So you've kind of got a bit of a split there, though, between the local movement for your sort of day-to-day activity, I suppose, and the longer distance movement for which might be for some of those other purposes that you've talked about. You do look at that in your book a bit and try and tease out those differences. But, I mean, is there... I suppose that leads to a question of whether you can identify actual long distance routes that go between certain places for given reasons. Is there any evidence for that sort of thing?
For long distance movement?
Yeah.
Well, there certainly is. And it depends, again, mobility is such a wonderful subject. It's very, very diverse throughout time. So there are no universals, and it goes up and down. But we certainly get long distance movement of people in prehistory. I mean, the Amesbury Archer, an early Bronze Age burial not far from Stonehenge, where we know that he was brought up, perhaps in the Swiss part of the Alps, but certainly from at a distance. And that's a long distance that this man has travelled, physically travelled himself. So rather different than just looking at the artefacts where it may have passed from hand to hand. He actually walked and sailed that journey. And then as you go through time, of course, you know, as the globe opened up, you can see huge distance being moved as merchants and pilgrims, you know, in the medieval period. I mean, people going to various pilgrimage centres in Europe and to the Holy Land was huge. I mean, there was a great big industry going on there. Going back in time to the Roman period, we know that there was a big tourist industry going on and people were moving around a lot for those reasons. So, you know, I think what we need to do is enliven the past with all of these different mobilities and these different movements. People were moving around.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And it goes back to this point that mobility is so fundamental to human life that if you control somebody's movements, you control them. And this has been the case for a long, long time, certainly since the medieval period.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Okay, so then the next question, which I find absolutely fascinating, is how did people know where they were going? So in eras pre-maps, pre-GPS, how did you actually know where you were trying to end up at? I mean, even if you look into the medieval period, you have things which look like map, like the Goth map and things like that. But actually, when you interrogate them properly, if you try to use those sorts of things to actually get from A to B, it wouldn't work terribly well. They're not terribly accurate devices. So how do people know where they're going?
Well, of course, we tend to look at the world a bit like a bird would look at it from above, and we've got used to seeing that. You know, we have satellite imagery which shows us what it looks like from above. And of course, as you rightly say, people didn't have that view in the past, and so their understanding of the world around them, their landscape, came from their knowledge of it on the ground, literally on the ground. And in terms of how do they know their way around, well, if you're brought up, if you live in an area and you move around in that area, you walk in that area, you know it really, really well. And it's a sort of knowledge that you could describe as an ambulatory knowledge. It's a knowledge that can only be gained from moving in that particular landscape. And so these people, I mean, they're essentially seeing the world as a wayfarer or a wayfinder. They know their way around because they just live within that landscape. They know it intimately. But again, they don't know it from above. They know it on the ground. So they'll know the route ways, and they will recognize at what point they need to make which turning. So it's not a set of instructions in their head. It's a kind of, it's what you might describe as knowing as you know as you go. You know, it's sort of something that develops out of your moving on foot. And so and that's very much a wayfarer's way of seeing the world. And so if you're in a foreign area, well, you might employ a wayfarer or wayfinder to help you through the way. You may follow a well marked out routeway, or if it's not well marked out, there may well be marks on trees, for example, symbols on trees, or patches of bark that have been cut away, or saplings bent in a particular way to point you in particular directions. That's known as trailblazing. So that's another way of determining where to go. But so there are a variety of ways, but it's you know, it's it, if you're moving in a an unfamiliar area, the risk of getting lost was serious.
So the trailblazing examples you gave there, you're not just making them up, are you? Because there are sort of ethnographic parallels for people employing those sorts of things. I think in sort of First Nation territories in North America, for instance, there's clear examples of people using those sorts of techniques.
Yes, absolutely. It's a well-known technique. The other thing, of course, is as people move along a trail, a number of people move along a particular line, they are impacting their landscape automatically. They're treading vegetation underfoot and pushing it back. And of course, as you're walking along and you may eat some fruit and throw it to one side, you will start to get particular fruit trees growing on the side. So you start developing very particular ecosystems along routeways. And so all of these things provide cues in the landscape. Or, for example, on particular pilgrimage routes, it may be marked out with I think it's in Sussex, they use yew trees at every particular at a particular distance. So, it helps you find your way. So there are a variety of ways of knowing where you're meant to be walking, where the route goes. But to us, in our modern minds, where we're so used to maps and particularly nowadays digital maps on our phone, it's so easy. It's very difficult to get lost, really, which is a great shame. I'm a big fan of getting lost.
And knowledge lost as well, I guess, for our inability to be able to spot those signs anymore. I was walking along a path this morning, actually, having read your book, thinking it's curious there are quite so many blackberries along this path, and maybe that's an example of some of that sort of knowledge. Right. Let's just pause for a moment and sort of move. I mean, we've already dabbled into the Middle Ages a bit, but the sort of the boundary between prehistory and historic times is the Roman period for a lot of places, and particularly here in Britain. The Romans come and they're famous for putting in the roads and building the road network, and that's one of the big things we associate them with. How important in terms of our knowledge of travel and the way people were moving around in the countryside were the Romans and the network they brought in? And I suppose just is that true that the Romans did bring in roads, and did they? And I suppose the one big question is, did they make the roads straight or not?
Well, I mean, did they bring in roads? I mean, I'm always a bit reticent talking about Roman roads, because whenever you talk about roads, you have a lot of experts on Roman roads who really fight quite vigorously for their little patch for the Roman roads. And it's very difficult to talk about Roman roads as part of sort of a broader discussion of roads more generally and mobility. But anyway, that hasn't stopped me in my book anyway. But in terms of did they bring roads with them? Well, I mean, of course they did. They built fantastic roads. I mean, splendid roads. I've excavated Roman roads in the past. I excavated a fantastic one in Southwark in London, beautifully well made, and they were incredibly well engineered, well made roads that stand the test of time. A number of them are still in use today, which shows how obviously they've been re-tarmacked and remade, but it just shows how crucial those Roman road links were. But did they bring Roman roads? Well, we now have growing evidence for Iron Age roads. There was a wonderful site in Sharpstone near Wroxeter where they excavated a road which for all the world looked like it should be a Roman engineered road, but the dating showed that it was Iron Age. We have Iron Age street grid pattern at Silchester, for example. And there are other Iron Age roads. And it just makes me wonder how many of the Roman roads are actually overlaying on top of earlier roads. I suspect a lot of them, an awful lot of them. So yes, Roman roads are quantitatively different. There's absolutely no getting away from the fact that the Roman road was really something special. But I do wonder whether actually it was more likely to be overlaid onto routes that already existed. The other thing to remember, of course, is that the Roman road network didn't just suddenly appear overnight. They didn't invade and suddenly overnight create this Roman road system. What we're looking at when we look at the Roman road network is a few hundred years worth of development and change, you know, so it didn't appear over time. When the Romans first arrived, no doubt they used existing routeways and then started developing them from there. And were they straight? Well, you know, some of the best known examples clearly are very, very straight. I mean, Romans were fantastic surveyors and fantastic engineers, but there are loads of Roman roads that aren't straight. And that's because they weren't looking at the world with a bird's eye view. They weren't using Google Maps on their phone to plonk it on. They were building it on the ground, so to speak. So it develops on the ground and it goes round corners. And, you know, they're very sensible when it comes to river crossings. They do it so it crosses the river the minimum number of times and stuff. But, they're not all dead straight. And the other thing, of course, is routeways and roads, routeways and pathways, after a length of time, you know, once they're there, they tend to remain. And after a length of time, they start to straighten out. I mean, you know, if it's been there a while, you tend to cut off the corners and straighten these things out. So Roman roads that are using a pre-existing series of routeways actually probably are using quite straight roads anyway. So, you know, I love Roman roads. I'm not, you know, I love people who study Roman roads. But I think we overplay this idea that the whole Monty Python sketch, you know, what did they ever do for us, bringing roads and all the rest of it? You know, well, actually, the Roman road system was something that developed over time. And it's very special and is used for centuries, millennia later. But, you know, I do question whether actually they were dead straight and just sort of imposed themselves on the landscape. No road ever imposes itself on a landscape. Roads develop from the landscape. And you can see this in the Roman roads where they use the geology around them and the engineering style of the roads changes depending on the landscape around it. So they develop up, they evolve from the earth.
So you've slightly blown my next question out of the water, but I'll ask anyway because I was going to say what would the imposition of a network, and you've just said there wasn't, of a network like that have done for the psychology of people moving around, because suddenly there were, you know, these better more constructed roads leading to all sorts of interesting places, which would presumably have meant the experience of traveling was quite different, but maybe it's not because there was already Iron Age antecedents to it.
Well, I mean, having said what I've just said, I still think that they are quantitatively different and that the experience of moving would have been different. Walking along a Roman road, I mean, they are beautifully compact and flat. You know, I've excavated them and they're wonderful things. And where you get potholes, they get filled in. I mean, in many ways, they're better than the roads we have now. So in that sense, I think moving along them would have been different. Whether people could have freely moved across along them is a different question. And, you know, I think many of these roads were constructed for military use, and they may well have been sort of dominated by soldiers moving up and down them. And actually, you know, ironically, even though they had a better road network, mobility may have become more difficult after the Roman invasion and arrival.
That's an interesting point. The sort of the legality and authority required to travel. Maybe we'll pop back into that in just a minute. But I just wanted to pick up on a couple of sections in your book relating to medieval travel that I found particularly interesting. So we're leaping forward again here a few centuries from the Romans. But pilgrimage. You've mentioned pilgrimages earlier, and you talk quite a lot about that in your book about how important the concept of pilgrimage was and how it kind of not only made people travel, but the very fact that lots of people were traveling kind of shaped the landscape of mobility itself. So can you give us sort of just a little synopsis of what you mean by that?
Yes, I mean, I think we probably forget nowadays just how important pilgrimage was, particularly in the medieval period in Britain. You would have had people going, you know, entire households going out on pilgrimages at particular times of the year, you know, particular holy days. And it would have been a rather fun time. I mean, there was almost sort of a festival a festival feeling around some of these pilgrimage centres during holy days. And you would have gone with your household and perhaps some neighbours, and you would have made a nice day of it, or maybe a long, you know, longer than that. And it would have all been, you know, rather fun. Of course, there's a flip side of that, which is wherever you have mobility as freedom, there's mobility as restriction. And so people were often forced to go on pilgrimages as penance for committing some crime, you know, adultery or whatever it might be. So, you know, it wasn't always fun for everyone, and others may have gone with their sackcloth on or barefoot or whatever. So the people had different experiences of pilgrimages, sometimes fun and gay and festival and full of festivities, and other times it would have been more difficult. But whatever, these pilgrimage routes to major centres like, for example, Canterbury, everyone along that route would benefit. I mean, you need people, you need inns to provide accommodation overnight and to provide food. You would have had, the ferrymen, or the Thames ferrymen did particularly well out of people going on pilgrimage down to Canterbury. So, you know, there was money to be made out of this. And of course, whenever there's any sort of mobility, it impacts the environment around it. So pilgrimage is exactly the same. You know, a whole industry, if you like, builds up along these pilgrimage routes to service people going on pilgrimage.
It sort of actually changes the landscape and has a significant impact on the way things happen. And that leads us on to another sort of area of travel, or a reason for travel, which was to do with animals and agriculture. And you have some very interesting content in your manuscript about the importance of droving and drovers, and also transhumance. So you probably need to explain what transhumance is, and maybe you need to explain what droving is as well. Just gives a sense about how important animals were and the transport of animals in the medieval period.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely fascinated by this subject. I love the idea that people were moving with their animals to such an extent through the medieval period. Really, it's the post-medieval period where it explodes and you get people droving and as you say, transhumance. The difference between the two: droving is when you take your animal to market, and so people would drove their animals across sometimes huge distances, you know, from Wales into London, for example, or from the Scottish Highlands all the way down into England to sell them in market. So for the animal, droving is a one-way street, you know, they go one way, they don't come back again. Transhumance is rather different. That's taking your animal up into upland areas for the summer and back down into the valleys for the winter, or if you're in a wetland area, you know, take them to the wetland over the summer and then dryland area in the winter, and so on. But moving animals around was a huge part of mobility through the whole of the historic period, probably through much of later prehistory as well, but really explodes in the post-medieval period. And you see, very much like pilgrimage, these routeways really fundamentally change our landscape, and they impact on the entire environment around it. Once again, drovers need accommodation. You know, there's you often get inns. Well, you do get inns that appear along droveways or driftways or greenways, they're sometimes called. The Drover's Arms or whatever they might be, a place for you to put your animals overnight, whether they're cows or sheep or geese or sometimes even pigs, so a field for them to graze and somewhere for you to sleep. And people like blacksmiths would have done really well out of drovers whenever there was a big market on, and smithies would set themselves up to service people as they're moving along these droveways. And again, you know, going to market, sort of a bit like going on a pilgrimage on a holy day, market days kind of have this air of festivity about them. All these people being brought together from disparate parts of the country, meeting up and intermingling and chatting and sharing gossip and sharing knowledge. You know, the markets were, you know, great big melting pots and of life, of humanity, all driven by the mobility of an animal.
So I'm just thinking, you mentioned earlier about the sort of the possibility in Roman roads that access to those Roman roads might have been restricted because they were primarily military transport routes, perhaps. How far is it possible for you as an archaeologist to get a sense of the limits that might have been imposed on people's ability to travel in the past, whether through legal restrictions or social or economic restrictions, I suppose? Can you see that at all?
Well, it's very, very difficult to see this in the archaeological record. And really, this is where we start to rely on the historic record to understand the kinds of restrictions involved with mobility. And it goes back to this point that mobility is so fundamental to human life that if you control somebody's movements, you control them. And this has been the case for a long, long time, certainly since the medieval period. I mean, we have the Statute of Winchester, 1285, which restricts people moving around at night time. So, you know, you might be caught by the night watch. And what are you doing up at this time? Because if you're not sleeping, then that means that you're probably sleeping during the day and therefore very limited economic value to people. So restriction is a big part of restricting mobility is a big part of controlling the people. And you see this through time. I mean, it kind of gets worse. And actually, it's not great now, to be honest. You know, we are more restricted now than I think we have been ever before in the past. But, you know, so on the one hand, people were restricted on the times of the day that they could move around. But at the same time, various Tudor poor laws and proclamations against vagabonds and so on meant that people actually were forced into, you know, the very lowest tier of society was forced into this constant moving around. So, you know, you get this sense that if you've got money, you're okay. You have a lot more freedom, but if you don't, you have a lot less freedom to move around. And actually, there's an economic and social division, but I think there's also a gender division as well. In that, if you're a young man and you're forced to move from town to town, then you could probably get by. And actually, there's probably a little bit of a libertine freedom about that. Going from alehouse to alehouse and enjoying the pleasures. As a young woman, that's a lot more difficult to do, and often unmarried women that moved around a lot in the medieval period were considered lewd or associated with illegitimate children and that sort of thing. So mobility is this wonderfully variable thing that is freedom for some people, restriction for other people. And you get this right the way through. It goes through to, the first enclosures where large tracts of the landscape are enclosed and all of a sudden previous routeways have either gone completely or been rerouted into different areas, or the later enclosures, parliamentary enclosures of the 18th century. So restriction is something that's restricting people's movements has gone on and on and on. And we still have problems today. But, you know, where you get restriction, you always get resistance. And so, you know, the flip side of the mobility coin to restriction is resistance to these restrictions. During the parliamentary enclosures, you had, or during the earlier enclosures, you had people known as levellers that would go out and literally level the hedges and the various boundaries that had been set up on across routeways. And incidentally, these people were known as the mob, mobile vulgus, they were called by the landowners. You know, the mob is literally a group of people identified by their type of mobility. Their movements define what they are, and they resisted against it. And then you can see this in, for example, the mass trespass at Kinderscout in the 1930s. We can resist, or even Gandhi's wonderful salt walk to resist the colonial power, the British salt tax. So, you know, movement can be freedom, but it can be oppression, but it can also be a form of resistance. And if you've ever gone on a protest, you know, these sort of long wandering forms of movement, a very particular type of movement in a protest march. Or of course, immobility is a form of protest. You know, think about the Occupy movement, just sitting down, refusing to budge. It's another form of protest. So mobility is all of these things. And whilst elite powers have always tried to control people's movements, people have always fought back with a different form of movement.
There's some fascinating social historical angles that underpin all this topic, isn't there? And I'm reminded actually that trespassing is a live topic now, isn't it? Because there's been a book just published by a chap called Nick Hayes, I think, called Trespass, which is sort of exploring the restrictions that still exist on people moving around Britain today. People are still coming to terms with that and trying to fight against it, I guess. Right, just moving to an end with some sort of practical tips for people, if we can. So when we're wandering around in the British countryside or elsewhere, I don't know how far such things would apply elsewhere. We've got a lot of listeners in the States, so I don't know whether there's any tips there. But can you give us any hints to how we can judge the likely age or original intention of a track or path or road that we're wandering along?
It's actually surprisingly difficult to find the date of a particular path. I mean, a Roman road is built in a very particular way, so a little more easy to identify, perhaps. But some of these, you know, these driftways, greenways that you see, some of the smaller ways, very difficult to determine what their date is. I think the simplest thing to understand... to try to identify Roman roads, I think the easiest thing is to look at maps, because they're pretty well mapped, they're very well studied, and I think even the OS maps for Britain have Roman roads marked on them. For these earlier ones, it's almost impossible to just walk along them and determine their date. Actually, what they need is serious scientific work to understand them. But you can, I mean, you know, Holloway's again, I mean, they're just wonderful. You don't have to go anywhere in particular. I mean, I'm up here in North Yorkshire and we have fantastic Holloway's. I've got some wonderful ones in the village just near me. And they are just so wonderful and evocative. And when life starts to get on top of you, actually, just walking down a Holloway and feeling the time depth makes me feel an awful lot better. So I would advise those. And as I said before, where we've dated, where they have been dated, and this work really is the pioneering work of Martin Bell, we can show that they have some serious heritage, you know, going back in some cases right back to prehistory. But it's really difficult to determine the date of a path just by walking it. I mean, looking at where they come from and go to is another way. You know, quite again, up here in North Yorkshire, we have a lot of big abbeys. And if they're coming from an abbey or going to an abbey, then, it seems sensible to assume that they're probably medieval in date. And the place name as well, I mean, that may give you an inkling as to what they are, and therefore you can sort of partly date them from that. But actually getting to the original date of them, that's the really difficult thing, because they get, you know, routeways, once it's there, it tends to remain there for a long, long time. And it gets sort of absorbed into different networks and used for different things and renamed and slightly altered and slightly engineered here and there. And routeways are just wonderful things to walk down anyway.
So you mentioned sort of the pleasure of the time depth experience of going down one of these Holloways and how that feels. Are there any sort of concrete examples of anywhere that you would go where you can get a really good sense of walking along an ancient path or route?
Well, Martin Bell has been working at on the South Downs a lot, where a lot of the Holloway's on the South Downs. Saddlescombe, for example, he's dated to potentially the Iron Age. He's also looked at another one, Liminge in Kent, which he's quite conclusively shown is certainly later prehistoric in date, in origin. But this is very pioneering work. And so, you know, we don't have dates on a lot of these Holloways. Some of them, because of the nature of them, you know, they're essentially negative features, are they are very, very difficult to date. So this is part of the point of my book, is I want to energize this understanding of the past. I want people to read it and embrace it and engage in it, but actually also do some research on parts, and let's start dating them, because they are datable. You just have to work really hard. If in terms of concrete examples, come up to North Yorkshire. Come up to North Yorkshire and look at some of the amazing paths on the North York Moors, for example. I spend my weekends. I'm a man obsessed. My family, thankfully, happily come along, but I think they've largely given up on me. You know, particularly the trods. You know, trods are wonderful things. They run across the North York Moors. You get them elsewhere. You get some in Cumbria and the Yorkshire Dales, and these are made of sort of large flagstones, and they're laid out, and they're likely to be medieval in date because some of them originate or go to some of the big abbeys. But I just love the name trod. I mean, you know, if there's ever a word that defines exactly what it is a trod. You know, you tread on a trod much as you ride on a road.
Absolutely. It's a very evocative word. It sounds quite Yorkshire as well, doesn't it? Trod. You can see how that would work in there with the accent there. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that maybe you might want to bring to the attention of our listeners? Any areas that you think are particularly interesting that we haven't gone over?
No, I mean, I think probably one of the last things that I would say that actually I find one of the really fascinating things about mobility is how it is so completely cultural. That if you're born and brought up in a particular country, you walk in a particular way. So mobility is an entirely cultural thing. You don't, you know, there's no human way of walking. You develop a walk. You walk like your parents walk. You know, you copy your parents, or you copy the cool kids at school, like John Travolta at the beginning of Saturday Night Fever. You know, he's got the coolest walk in the world, walking down the Bee Gees behind, you know, singing, "You can tell by the way I use my walk. I'm a lady. I'm a woman's man. No time to talk." You know, you can tell by the way he uses his walk. He's a cool guy. He walks in a cool way. You know, so walking is a very culturally specific thing. And I find that utterly fascinating. That's the side that we really struggle to get from archaeology.
That was Dr. Jim Leary. Hopefully he'll find a publisher for his book Rome sometime soon so that you can read more about this subject. In the meantime, if you want to find out more about medieval pilgrimage, just go to historyextra.com and search for pilgrimage, and you should find some great material to read. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow for another lecture from our 2019 History Weekends.